Well, that was marvelous, unfortunately. Thank you, Stanley. The title of my paper, and there may be some spaces for people to sit up front and down the aisle here. There's no point in standing through this horror. So if you want to come up and... The title of this paper is The Habitations of the Word. Plato's Phaedrus has seemed to some critics to have too many subjects, to be drawn first in this direction and then in that, as if those uncooperative horses which it has created, flown, and thereby caused to be celebrated, were pulling apart its pages. Is it about love or about oratory, the scholars ask? Is it a vision or a recitation, an allegory or an exercise? It is at least all of these, but I should like to believe that this extraordinary dialogue is fundamentally concerned with the local habitation of the name and with the nature of honest eloquence, the speech which is just, the speech which can be believed, and that it goes about its business by providing us with a classification by means of model and example of the various residences of the word, at all times seeking the best address. When we ask ourselves what a word is, we may be wondering whether it is a complex set of sounds or a more or less regular march of marks which have come to have a special significance because of all the context they've been used in, each one shaving its sense more closely to the skin. Or we may be inquiring about the word's relations or roots, or puzzling ourselves about the unenviable middle place it takes between thing and thought, object and idea. But I wish to ask the word a few questions about its native state instead. I want to know where it is from. The Phaedrus opens with a curious exchange between Socrates and Phaedrus concerning a new composition by the noted rhetorician Lysias, which Phaedrus has heard only that morning. Obviously intended as a display piece to demonstrate the orator's art by taking a difficult, if not perverse, point of view, Lysias's speech argues that an impersonal lust presents in principle a better suit for the favor of a beautiful boy's body than love can, that selfish pleasure is a safer motive and provides a more secure environment for its object than passion does. And Socrates shows an immediate and ironic interest in this subject, wishing only that Lysias had proved a similar superiority for poverty and age, not excluding Socrates' other debilities. And the initial implication of Socrates' little joke is certainly a serious one, namely that Lysias' composition has a use, that it might be employed by anyone who had the orator's leave or had paid his fee, and had a nice young man in mind. For it was out of just such an expectation of payment that Lysias had written his brief for the defense in the case where two men had loved the same boy and come to blows over him, and again for a similar quarrel over the purchase of a slave girl, and yet another time for the prosecution of a guardian guilty of embezzlement, or when money had tempted his pen to the defense of a farmer accused of cutting down a sacred olive grove. In one case only, as far as we know, did Lysias himself speak what he had written. On that occasion, he prosecuted Erosthenes for the execution without trial of Lysias' own brother, Polemarchus. And when Socrates asks Phaedrus to repeat the oration for him, Phaedrus protests, calling himself an amateur, presumably with respect to the feat of memory it would require to fulfill Socrates' request, and complaining that he should not be expected to reproduce in a moment what it had taken such a wonderful writer weeks in the inspired labor of his leisure to create. Socrates then pretends to believe his friend can do just that. He suggests that Phaedrus has already badgered Lysias into repeating his speech. More than this, that he has begged the loan of the manuscript in order to study it closely, commit it to memory even, and that Phaedrus has made his way just now beyond the city's walls in order to rehearse what he has memorized, to release into the indifferently receptive country air the winged words which he has so earnestly and carefully caged. As it turns out, Phaedrus has borrowed the manuscript and has it held in his left hand, hidden under his cloak. He has it held in his left hand because this speech, these words, belong to the black horse of desire, the left-handed horse whom the charioteer must check if the soul is to rise. Now, Socrates insists on hearing the entire work, re-spoken, not silently re-read, rather than the summary Phaedrus was hoping to give him, and by that gift demonstrating, if not his command of the art of verbal memory, at least his ability to recall in the right order the principal points of an oration, an art which, much later, Cicero and Quintilian would call a memory for race, things, objects, subjects, important points in a discourse, instead of the more strenuous and particular one for verba, words,